Hello and welcome. I'm Dandy Zhu, and you're listening to Digital Health Forward, a podcast dedicated to sharing the stories of healthcare entrepreneurs, leaders, and executives who are moving the digital health industry forward. Today, I had a chance to chat with Adam Odesky, CEO and co-founder of Sensely. Sensely is an empathy-driven conversational platform that introduces an always-on connection between insurance companies and healthcare systems and their members or patients. By incorporating Sensely, enterprises are able to influence behavior, increase engagement, lower costs, and enhance the member experience. Sensely is currently deployed in 10 different countries, serving over 3 million users to date. In this conversation, Adam and I explore the world of chatbots and avatars and AI, and we hear his insights on how Sensely has helped support health systems and payers in engaging with their patients and members, from symptom checking to helping book vaccines to managing chronic diseases around the world. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Adam. It's nice to meet you.
Hey, Dandy. Yeah, it's great to meet you as well. How are you doing?
Doing well. Great to have you on the show and excited to learn more about Sensely today.
Excited for the conversation. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. So to start, wanted to learn more about your personal story and a little bit of your background. So I saw that you spent decades at tech companies mostly, so Oracle, Microsoft, and Intel before you started to build Sensely. So tell us about where your interest in healthcare came from and a little bit more about that inception story.
Yeah, sure. Yes. The lost decades of tech. No, they're actually really great experiences. So I actually started up my career in tech right out of college. I got a degree in computer science from University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And it was right around the 2000s. And I had dabbled a bit in startups for a company called Cyent. But it was right around, you know, the last dot-com boom. So I remember the first company I started with, like, really tanked, like, after a few months after I started there, just because of the crash and everything that happened afterwards. So I wanted to find a job that was a bit more conservative. And I started working at Oracle in Chicago. And what's interesting is Oracle at that point in time, a few other companies at that point in time were experimenting a lot with voice, trying to develop user interfaces that you can talk to over the phone. You may know them now as these kind of IVR chatbots or IVR robots, if you will, that you call and sometimes you get annoyed. Sometimes they're awful useful information and redirect you to the best available outcome that you're seeking. But at Oracle, my main job was to build these interactive voice conversations and build the platforms for the infrastructure to support these kind of voice conversations. And the goal of these conversations was, for Oracle specifically, was around personal information management. So looking and listening to things such as email and calendar appointments and, you know, in your files and, you know, things like that you do in your everyday life or everyday work life. And one of the key value propositions for those was, you're a busy executive or you're a busy person, you're driving in the car a lot, you want to be able to call in to listen to all this information that you can get from the web. We didn't really have smartphones back then. So, you know, getting your email over the smartphone was, or over the phone, the feature phone at that point in time in general was really difficult. So my career was really revolved around, initially with these tech companies, Oracle and Microsoft, around telecom and around voice, around building these interactive conversational interfaces to assist with personal informational tasks, to assist with customer service. So if you think, you know, of the big brands and the phone numbers that are available for these brands, like United Airlines or E-Trade or Hilton Hotels or something like that, you typically call them and you get into this voice agent. And this voice agent's job is to really listen to you, understand what you want, and assist you along the way, whether it's actually assisting you through additional conversation or transferring the phone or the number to the most appropriate call center that can assist you. So I sort of cut my teeth at building these types of applications, both inside Oracle, inside Microsoft. There was a subsidiary there, it was called Tell Me Networks, which really did a lot of work for large enterprises, for sales, for hospitality, for airlines, et cetera. And so that's sort of where my early career was. And that's sort of what created the path for me to work on Sensely and to work on healthcare interfaces.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of this voice and IVR was already being adopted by hospitality, perhaps e-commerce and other industries. But what was the state of adoption for voice technology in healthcare at the time? Why did you decide to focus on healthcare and insurance?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I really saw a gap specifically in healthcare and insurance. And one of the reasons, because of just the business model, the way these industries work, right? If you're looking at hospitality, if you're looking at airlines, if you're looking at, you know, other sort of big industries like retail, they want to sell more. And they want to make sure that products that you buy get the best, the best possible customer support. And they want to make sure that this best possible support that you get comes at a really low cost. You want to create as much access as possible, but you don't necessarily want to hire thousands and thousands of people to the point where your margins start suffering. And
right.
Perhaps, you know, you report a loss. So the incentives are all there in these type of industries to be able to deploy these type of IVR systems, to be mm-hmm. available to everybody and do these things. In healthcare, you know, the business model is a little bit different, especially in the US, where you have mostly a fee-for-service industry. You don't have the same kind of incentives in terms of reducing costs. And therefore, that part of the industry hadn't really taken off at that time because of the incentives. But I saw a huge opportunity because, you know, there was a social need for a lot of people, particularly older patients, patients with chronic conditions, to get this help and support on a more frequent basis, in a more understanding sort of basis, rather than just having a call center call you. The idea there kind of spanned not just like what IVR was at the time, but also what IVR could be in the near future. So what I mean by that is that, you know, typically people call in into these phone numbers or to these phone lines to get the help that they need. Later on, maybe 5 years from that point, what happened was that, you know, the phone lines started calling you. And my thought was like, well, how do we kind of combine these two technologies together, both the inbound and the outbound piece, to make patient monitoring and patient interaction much more effective? Because one of my experiences with my grandmother is that she has a chronic condition and she only saw the doctor this condition about 2 to 3 times a year. And she would end up in the hospital as well 2 to 3 times a year. And the reason why she would end up in the hospital is that, you know, her condition would exacerbate to the point where she needed to go to the hospital. Nobody was checking in on her. And so the idea was initially, well, how do we actually use this IVR to just make regular, you know, automated phone calls to her and check in, see how she's doing, you know, have her tell us the blood pressure, have her tell us the weight, make some calculations on that. And maybe we can inform the doctor early enough so that, you know, they can perform an intervention so you wouldn't need such a hospitalization. And that piece of it, that sort of that monitoring and that intervention piece, was actually the one of the core business models initially that would work in healthcare.
Yeah.
Because you do have reimbursements for this kind of monitoring. And with the Affordable Care Act at that point in time coming out by Obama, it would have, it created some incentives, like with accountable care organizations and other entities.
Right.
They would be incentivized to reduce, you know, very expensive readmissions to the hospital so the patient doesn't have to, you know, get to a point where their condition is really, really bad. And so even though there wasn't the pure sort of labor automation model that, you know, other industries were focused on, those industries were already mature. But this sort of monitoring model, I thought was going to be really interesting for the healthcare industry and a way to take this technology and start really trying to impact patient care as well as patient effectiveness.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like there is a good timing piece to that with the ACA. And I want to dive definitely more into the different use cases you guys have built for healthcare. But before we do that, want to spend a little bit of time just setting some context and terminology for the audience. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about Sensu, we're talking about this conversational platform, and there's terms being thrown around about chatbots and avatars, machine learning and AI being part of that. So breaking it down for us, what exactly are chatbots and avatars? How is AI being used as part of the platform? And how does this all work from a general technology standpoint?
Yeah, sure thing. And, you know, I get confused sometimes still. but really to define a chatbot is that it's a conversational agent. It's an automated piece of software that engages in the conversation with a human.
Mm-hmm.
So a human types or speaks, and then this chatbot or this conversational agent responds, and they take multiple turns going back and forth. That's the essence of a chatbot or a conversation. This turn-taking conversation between human and a machine, sometimes a machine and a machine now, kind of like where we're talking about if I was a robot, for instance. AI, in this particular case, is how intelligent those responses by the machine are and how intelligent can you make those responses using a variety of quote-unquote AI technologies. The first one is just basic software, building basic logic. If you go further, they go into statistical models where statistics are being used to calculate what kind of response you can provide back to the human, and all the way to neural networks, which is really kind of where the focus of AI right now is, basically taking all the data that you've collected to date, constantly using that data to improve the experience and improve the quality of the responses that are provided back to the user, either based on the questions that they ask or certain selections that they make, et cetera. And so this idea is where the chatbot is the actual conversation, the user interface. The AI is the kind of the brain behind it that does these calculations of how to talk to the user. And machine learning is sort of even further, that calculations around the data that the system already has in order to feed this AI engine to have a high quality, effective conversation. Now, avatars, and that's something that we specialize in, take the chatbot sort of user interface to the next level. A typical chatbot that you see right now is a text-based chatbot where you can either talk to it using a text message like SMS or WhatsApp or, you know, any other of these chat programs that you're familiar with. With avatars, we've taken it to the next level, and you're now able to have what we call a multi-sensory, multi-modal conversation with the chatbot. What I mean by multi-sensory is that in addition to just seeing the text on the screen, you're also able to see this kind of digital human that you're interacting with. So this digital human has a face, it has a voice, it's dressed appropriately, and it's, you know, playing a certain role that it's expected to play in the context of the conversation. And voice is basically used, you know, text-to-speech voice, a computer-generated voice, as well as speech recognition, which is used to listen to the user, is also used in the context of this conversation. So it's what I mean is multiple sensors. You can visually see it, you can also listen to it. So it's more than text. We've really focused on this idea because we wanted to make healthcare conversations more human-like and more interactive. Mm-hmm. These type of conversations are really high stakes in that people are typically very anxious when they enter it. They want answers fast. Their kid is sick, or their parents are sick, or they're really worried about something. And by being able to provide these type of rich interfaces, we're able to go beyond, go further than a typical text message would. We're able to show empathy. We're able to acknowledge what the user is saying, reassure them, which is really important in making sure that the experience is smooth and the patient feels satisfied at the end.
Wow, that is fascinating. I would love to observe one of these avatar conversations. Mm-hmm. How does the avatar actually pick up on things like emotion or facial expression, or is it able to do things like that?
It's able to in certain context. Certain contexts you want to do that, certain contexts you don't. Mm-hmm. Kind of the state of the technology right now is that speech recognition and natural language processing are the primary modes for picking up conversation and then in the intention of users.
Yeah.
You know, natural language speech recognition converts, you know, voice to text. And then natural language processing is then used to look at that text, to parse that text, to really understand what is the meaning, what is the intention that the user wants in the words that are actually there. And that's the primary mode. We use, you know, speech recognition and natural language processing quite often for letting people just speak what their problems are, what their, you know, symptoms are, what their issues are, and why they're contacting a certain healthcare provider or a certain insurance company. The how can I help you sort of interface. Emotion recognition beyond that is primarily used to understand whether the person is upset, whether the person is, you know, angry or showing any other emotion in that case. Because you want to address those things, particularly in healthcare conversations. Mm-hmm. Psychosocial issues, like for instance, anxiety and depression, are very prevalent. People with chronic conditions and people needing health support. So these type of recognition systems, like visual recognition, to recognize emotion on a face. There's some really good ones out there that can recognize, you know, various emotions like anger and sadness and, you know, surprise and things like that. And they're really used to understand what is the patient's state and what additional help or services do I want to offer to that patient. Maybe they want to speak to, you know, a psychotherapist. Maybe they want to take an additional like PHQ-9 exam or something like that to see if they have anxiety or depression. So that's how we leverage these other sensors beyond the speech recognition and the natural language processing.
Interesting. And so when Sensely first started out, how did you think about what use cases you wanted to build the chatbot and the platform for, given the wide range of different things in healthcare you could help automate with voice and text?
Mm-hmm. Healthcare is really hard from a business model perspective, especially in the US. Hospitals, doctors' offices are typically incentivized to see every single patient that needs help, just because, you know, that's the way the reimbursement model works. Mm-hmm. With chronic conditions that I mentioned in particular, with the Affordable Care Act, there were new incentives that were being kind of developed, as I mentioned, to help reduce these readmissions, to help reduce some of the costs of care. And we thought that that was the right target for us to be able to focus on, in that, like, if we can manage these chronic conditions and we can reduce costs and we can reduce readmissions, there's reimbursements and there's incentives available for us to succeed as a company. And that's where we initially focused on. targeting patients with chronic conditions. So we develop modules for congestive heart failure or for diabetes, for COPD, and some of the other of the most kind of prevalent conditions. And really the decision was like, what is the level of impact that we can make given the reimbursement landscape and the business model landscape that exists at the moment? And, you know, diabetes, COPD, CHF kind of bubbled up to the top as the top diseases that we could be monitoring in order to make money, as well as obviously help as many patients that we can. As the years went on, we started working more and more with governments and national health systems. They saw an immediate need for what we were offering, because we're automating labor, we're reducing readmissions, and we can also make recommendations using AI that were appropriate for the patient and for what they needed. And so beyond the chronic condition work, where the company really started taking off is in the area of the symptom checker. And the symptom checker, so, you know, one of the issues from a business model with chronic conditions is there's a fairly small cohort of patients that can use these sort of tools. Versus the symptom checker is something that, you know, is population based. Anybody who has a symptom or anybody who has any healthcare concern can go to the symptom checker, communicate their needs, and then get interviewed based on their condition and specific questions, and then get recommended an appropriate outcome, whether to, you know, go to the emergency room or see a doctor within a particular time frame, or go to a telemedicine visit. Obviously, that's becoming very popular, and get self-care information. And the business model for that was actually really amazing, because we were able to show that we can make a more appropriate recommendation to the patient than a patient would otherwise if they had no such tool. And so we're able to show, particularly in the National Health Service in the UK, where we have a very large deployment, that we can shift about 21% of the cost by shifting people, by recommending that people go to doctor's appointments, for instance, in telemedicine, rather than go to emergency rooms, where a lot of very scared patients end up if they don't know what's wrong with them.
Yeah.
And so we're able to show that, you know, very massive cost shift across an entire population. This is kind of became the bread and butter of what the company does, are deploying these symptom checkers with insurance companies and with governments and with national health systems around the world, because of that that cost savings, because those type of organizations, particularly the insurance companies, are very much incentivized to provide these sort of tools and digital assistance in order to make the recommendations, so, you know, they can control their costs and control their reimbursements as well. And so that's where the business model really became more firm. Mm-hmm. Combining the chronic condition experience that we have, but also focusing more on a population-based set of use cases like the symptom checker in order to make even a bigger impact.
So when you shifted from monitoring chronic conditions and helping manage that to the symptom checker business model, how much of the content and the algorithms and sort of the technology underlying the conversational platform was able to be transferred? And how do you even go about starting to create all the content that is required to power it?
Yeah, at the core of what we do is our conversational avatar platform. So we built that. That was the first thing we ever built, is this ability, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, to basically have a platform that converses with a user using the avatar, using voice, using natural language processing, et cetera. So that underlying platform we built first before building any content on top of it. And so the first content that we built were these chronic condition modules. And we partnered with some of the best systems in the US to build those modules, including Kaiser Permanente. And the symptom checker we actually built in a collaboration with the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic had about 30 years of experience in their nurse call line that they've made available for their patient population. So it's kind of that traditional IVR service, if you will, but is not backed by a bot. But you call up a phone number, a nurse answers, a patient communicates the symptom, and then the nurse has a set of questions based on the symptom, like a triage book.
Yeah.
That they basically go through and ask the patient before kind of coming up with an outcome. So Mayo Clinic had been running this nurse line for over 30 years. They had tons of data. They had tons of insights. And with our partnership, they actually ended up being an investor in the company as well. We took a lot of that data, a lot of those insights, and built that and put that content on top of our avatar conversational platform. And so that's how the symptom checker was built, with that type of collaboration. And the platform itself is set up in a way so that any kind of clinical content or administration content, any kind of conversational content, can be easily developed and deployed onto the Sensely platform. And that's one of the things that we worked really hard on to make the platform as flexible as possible for any kind of person to develop this kind of content. We call it a no-code platform, where you basically use a visual drag and drop system to develop your conversations and then deploy them onto either mobile apps or websites or chatbot applications. So these applications can be very easily developed. And that's kind of a similar type of process that we followed in building both the chronic disease management components as well as the symptom checker components.
Very cool. I mean, that's amazing that you had such a wealth of data to draw upon and to sort of codify into things that were clinically rigorous as well, right? Since they were done in real world for decades already. So I guess when we think about how you guys have expanded, I read a bit about how you worked with the NHS in the United Kingdom. And, you know, we talked about Kaiser Permanente in the US and Mayo Clinic, but also it looks like you guys have been working with the National Institute of Biomedical Innovation in Japan and Swiss companies such as Medi24. So I'm curious what the thinking is behind the geographic expansion and how easy it is to also localize some of these products for different languages.
Yeah, that's a really good question. The major business model, as I mentioned, for Sensely was to be able to shift costs and to automate labor. The U.S. being a fee-for-service system, we didn't realize early success in the U.S. because it was just very outside of the chronic conditions, it's very hard to enter and penetrate. But many, many countries around the world have either have socialized healthcare systems like the NHS or have insurance companies that are really focused on cost savings and managing very large patient populations. And so a lot of our work had come down to the most massive impacts that we can make around the world. So the NHS was a massive project. The Swiss, Switzerland, Japan, Japanese are both socialized systems with a strong payer component and insurance component. But there, you can think of these countries are sort of the most progressive when it comes to understanding healthcare, you know, from a financial perspective, how to give patients the best possible experience, but how to also intelligently manage costs. And those are the countries that demanded our products more than the other countries. And that's where we went. With regards to translations, we also put into our platform very early on, and this stems from my experience with IVR, this ability to plug in dynamically any text-to-speech or any speech recognition engine. So very easily you can flip a switch and the platform can speak another language besides English. You know, now we speak over 32 different languages.
Oh, wow.
So we have the top ones like Spanish and German and Italian and French. We also have Mandarin Chinese and Cantonese and Japanese, and we're continuously adding languages as well. So we built that early on when we were building the conversational platform. We were unique in that sense. We're still unique in that sense where we can have this, we call it an advanced or super chatbot, if you will, that offers, you know, both the avatar experience as well as the multilingual experience. With regards to your question of how easy it is to localize these experiences, there's several components that go into the localization process. The first part is the actual translation, right? Like you can take English content, like with the symptom checker, and use a medical translator to translate that content into another language. And that typically, you know, takes a few weeks to a month, depending on what the project is and the scope of content that's required to translate. Mm-hmm. And then you also have a localization process. The localization process is really where those unique parameters of a particular language and of the particular country that you're deploying to get configured. So at the base level, it's, you know, configuring the right emergency numbers to call, right? We have 911 here. They have 999 in the UK. You also have to be concerned about medication names, where, you know, different countries have different medications and pronounce and think of these medications as different brands. So there's a lot of these little nitpicky details that you have to concern about. And so what we typically do is we have a professional translation agency that we work with, and they're actually geared towards this type of localization and translation that's geared towards specific languages and countries. And that's how we've been able to deploy and localize this content all around the world. And the process itself has actually have become pretty sufficient, although we do say that we don't use machine translation for any of the work that we do. It's just not good enough and high quality enough. We actually need real medical linguistic translators on the team to be able to perform these functions.
Wow. I mean, that is amazing how many languages you guys have been able to onboard already, and very exciting to hear the geographic breadth that you're operating in. I would love to understand a little bit more about the impact that you guys have had in the UK. You mentioned this 20% cost savings figure. Would love to just dive more into what you've built there with them in partnership mm-hmm. with the Ask NHS mobile and web apps mm-hmm. And how that has also helped grow the company during the pandemic mm-hmm. as well.
Ask NHS app as an app that is offered in the App Store in the UK market, both on iOS and Android. The core components of Ask NHS are built by Sensely. The very kind of core component of Ask NHS is a symptom checker. And the symptom checker is basically used to understand what the patient's symptoms are, lead a patient through a triage, and recommend an appropriate outcome and actually perform the last mile integration, whether it's booking an appointment in a doctor's office, they call it a surgery practice, whether it's transferring to the nurse line. The UK has a national call center called the 111, which is staffed by nurses, and it's used as a non-emergency type of line that anybody in the UK or around the country can access. And so the idea of the symptom checker is basically to perform signposting or navigation with these various services, whether it's an A&E, accidents and emergency room, call center, via telemedicine, or a doctor's appointment. And so we deployed the service in the UK, got really good adoption. We have about 400,000 active patients using it today. And the way it sort of works is that we actually compare the outcomes that we provide or we recommend to patients to the outcomes that the patients otherwise would have chosen. And mm-hmm. we both survey these patients about what they would have done, as well as look in the medical record sometimes to figure out what they actually did. So there's a combination of real data and survey data that we combine in this calculation process. And we take the cost of these various services that are provided by the NHS, whether it's a GP, a doctor appointment, a call center call, or a nurse line call, or an emergency room visit. And we basically combine and add up the services that the patient would have used versus the services that the patient ended up using after we gave him this recommendation. And that's where that 21% cost reduction comes from, is that delta between what the patient would have done versus what the patient actually did using Ask NHS and Sensely.
Makes sense. I also read about how you guys were helping book flu vaccines through the mm-hmm. apps, which mm-hmm. helped relieve the burden on a lot of busy clinics and their receptionists as mm-hmm. well. How have you guys been thinking about expanding into COVID-19 vaccine support, given mm-hmm. the context of today?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned with the Ask NHS app, the symptom checker was one of the services that we provided. But as I mentioned before, the platform is very flexible in that it can you can create many different services, many different customizations with it, anything really conversational that you want to communicate with your members or your patients about. And so in COVID, very early on, we built a COVID navigation tool that if you had particular symptoms, we would provide you information about what you should do. And it was obviously time aware because, the information changed on a regular basis. We also started adding things like flu vaccines because we wanted people to be more cautious in how they booked these vaccines to make sure that, the doctor was available and the proper PPE and protection were taking place. And so the appointments were available just in those particular slots where these type of flu vaccinations could be done in a safe way. And recently we introduced the Sensely vaccine bot. I think that's what you're mentioning. It's available in the NHS now. It's available in other places like Japan and the US. And the goal of the vaccine bot is to provide information about the vaccine, the various vaccines that are out there, whether it's Pfizer or Moderna or AstraZeneca, provide appointment booking services in the places where we support appointment booking, like the NHS, provide information on whether or not, or kind of a quiz on whether or not you qualify for the vaccine and when will you qualify for the vaccine. And then ultimately, keep this type of service up to date as the information, both information as and the logistics of who can get the vaccine actively changes. We built the initial version of the vaccine bot in about a day, and then we're able to scale it across many countries in the next week or so. And we did the similar with COVID. And so as these type of events occur, we're continuing adding on new services beyond the symptom checker, beyond chronic care to the platform that we believe are both relevant and timely to the various global healthcare issues that are happening around the world.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a huge competitive advantage to have built this platform to be so flexible and easy to customize, given how quickly information is changing, especially in the context of COVID, right?
That's right. Yeah, we have a lot of our clients, we provide a conversation design as a service. So we have a team of staffed linguists with PhDs in linguistics that provide some of these bespoke services to clients who need them. But ultimately, what we're seeing more and more are clients taking our tools and developing and maintaining their own conversations and their own services that are relevant and specific to them. And they're having a lot of success doing it. So this is definitely something I see as a future of both conversation design, as well as how new services are going to be rolled out in record times in the future.
Yeah, very exciting. I realize we haven't talked about the insurance navigation part of the business as much. So tell us a bit about how you're working with insurance companies too.
Yeah, sure. We have a product called the Insurance Front Door. And really the goal of the Insurance Front Door is to really truly understand what the member desires and offer, you know, both the services in a conversational format that we can offer. You know, for example, I want to pay my bill, or I want to file a claim, or I need to add a dependent to my policy. I lost my card. What should I do about it? But also services that insurance companies have that are really hard to discover. Many insurance companies have a telemedicine service, for instance, or they may have a psychotherapy service or other benefits that they offer to their membership base. And the idea behind the Front Door service is really have our virtual assistant, our avatar, live on either the insurance company's website or main page, or inside, a member portal, or inside a mobile app. And increasingly, although this insurances have been, not as fast as others, they're very, very bullish on, building new types of engaging, modern channels for members to contact, like mobile apps, like chatbots. And so we're leveraging a lot of that expertise and making the Front Door available inside those channels as well, like inside a mobile app, inside a WhatsApp bot. In Japan, we're doing a Line. In China, we're doing WeChat, right? Or where the most popular kind of chat applications are.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you go to this front door and you naturally describe what you're interested in. And the front door is split into the administrative services that I talked about, and also healthcare services. So we work with a lot of health insurance on this. So the idea is we want to combine for an insurance company, have a single point of contact, whether you have a health concern, whether you have an administration concern, whether you have a customer service concern or some sort of a sales concern. We want to have a single, we call it a single brand ambassador, a single face to the member. And that's really kind of where the avatar plays a strong role, because what insurance companies have been doing with us is they've been customizing the avatar to fit their own brand image and their brand parameters. I'll give you an example. In AXA in Hong Kong, there's an app called Emma. And Emma is really it's an avatar. It's a facial representation of a virtual assistant. She's there on your mobile phone, on your website, inside a chatbot, basically ubiquitous. And her job is to be your primary customer service agent. And you communicate all sorts of things to Emma. You can communicate your health concerns, in which case we invoke the symptom checker. You can communicate administration concerns. And that's where we have these other conversations that we built in the front door, like claims filing and dependents and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the idea is a single brand, it's a single point of contact and a single relationship that you build with the company. And that's really where the insurance companies got really excited about our platform, because they can build this high quality visual experience, combining all of their brand elements to communicate to their members in a unique voice, no matter where or what channel the member is accessing.
Are there any situations that you've run into where companies don't want the voice and the avatar and they prefer text? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really it's a question of your brand, and it's a question of what sort of interfaces and channels that you want to make available to your members. So our platform allows both chat, a text-based interface, as well as a voice-based interface or an avatar-based interface, and the member can actually switch between them. And so if they want voice, they click on the microphone button, and the avatar starts speaking to them. If they want text, they click the button again. And it turns into a chatbot. So we thought that offering these users the best possible interface that they desire is important. In some cases, with some clients, you can either choose the avatar that you'd like. So you have a several different characters that you can pick from. So we thought that flexibility and customization, specifically at the member level or the user level, is really important to get the kind of experience that the member wants. But yeah, we definitely have chat-only interfaces that are in use. We have voice-only interfaces, and we have this hybrid voice and text interface. That's probably the most popular one. In fact, we recently ran a survey in the NHS, and we asked people whether they prefer seeing the avatar and whether they like that the avatar is talking to them. And 4 out of the 5 survey answers actually that cared preferred seeing the avatar, and about 2 out of the 3 prefer the avatar speaking to them. So it's not for everybody. And that's why it's important to have that choice. Some people, if you're in a loud train or somewhere in public, you don't want to be chatting with the avatar. We don't want you to be chatting with the avatar. she may reveal something that you don't want
others hearing. Right, especially health information.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why we put in that functionality to choose the mode that's most convenient for you where you are.
Got it. Got it. Well, it seems like there are endless possibilities to extend this technology. As you were talking, I was just thinking about how I could have one of these avatars be like one of my personal assistants or something. Mm-hmm. But what are you guys thinking about in terms of expansion plans, whether that's geographically or into other products or use cases or other industries?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the addressable market, obviously, for healthcare insurance is giant, especially if you look at it from a global context. Mm-hmm. You know, hundreds of countries, huge, huge insurance premiums, healthcare costs, expenditures, et cetera. So our goal is to be this global virtual assistant platform for healthcare and insurance. You know, we started out with the symptom checker and chronic care management, but we see a lot of horizontal expansion into new use cases that are relevant to clients around the world. So we're continuously adding content that solves a particular problem, whether it addresses a concern that members have that, you know, is not being taken care of well by customer service, whether it's adding additional chronic conditions to the mix, because we find out from conversing with the patients, you know, maybe there's a high prevalence of asthma, you know, or something like that in a particular country. So we're constantly adding this content. One other interesting point kind of where we're going that I'd mentioned in the insurance space is, you know, underwriting is a huge business inside the insurance space, right? Collecting the right kind of information to make the best decision about whether the member will qualify for a particular policy or what the rate should be for that particular risk level that you have to take. And one of the kind of core issues with underwriting is the quality of disclosure, in that if you're, you know, trying to write a healthcare policy or a life policy, you have to ask, you know, healthcare questions. Sometimes you have to talk to the doctor or have that person go to a doctor appointment to do a physical. And where the avatar is getting increasingly good at is improving the honesty and the quality of disclosure than what typically people would get from talking to a telewriter over the phone.
Oh, interesting.
We did a pretty significant pilot recently where we surveyed about, surveyed about 300 patients. They had conversations both over the phone with a human, as well as had conversations with the avatar. And we were asking, you know, some personal questions because you need those answers in order to write a policy, whether you have any chronic conditions, whether you smoke, drink, or use any other substances, if you've ever had surgery, things like that. And what the outcome of that pilot was is that quality of disclosure on the avatar, so the amount of honesty compared to the prevalence rates of certain conditions like diabetes, heart failure, you know, alcoholism, et cetera, was about 3 times higher than the level of disclosure that these patients provided to a human over the phone. And so what we discovered is that people are actually more open and honest with the avatar about communicating these conditions. And this actually relates to the research that my co-founder, Dr. Ivana Schnoor, who's a clinical psychologist, had done in her prior life and prior startups and the universities that she was a part of. In that when you would put people, particularly people that were anxious or had any sort of social anxiety, into such situations with the avatar, so there was no human involved, and people thought that this is an avatar, it's non-judgmental, that level and that openness increased with the avatar as opposed to a human. And the research suggests that, you know, people, when they're talking to this avatar, they don't feel like they're being judged versus, you know, talking to a human. So they're much more likely to open up and to describe these situations. And, you know, obviously these kind of services are going to be important for both the healthcare and insurance and other industries beyond that. And that's sort of where the future area that we're kind of working very hard on in terms of making these avatars more empathetic, more engaging, more open, so that we can get this high quality information and ultimately have good conversations with people that help them along the way.
Yeah, the social behavior and psychology elements of this are so interesting. On one hand, you know, I totally understand the not passing judgment and creating a more safe space for people to share honest information. But on the flip side, I was thinking maybe there's a world where people actually feel more comfortable lying to mm-hmm. a bot versus to a human, you know? So I thought it might've gone the other way, but it's interesting that that's backed by research.
Yeah, it's psychology. Back by research. And yeah, that's the data that we have. Yeah, it's interesting. There is probably a level of, you know, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't speak too deep on it. But in many of our encounters, beyond just this pilot that we ran, it's interesting if you look at the kind of things that people tell the avatar. For instance, in one of our chronic care conversations with an elderly patient, he really built a very interesting relationship with the avatar. And his wife started complaining to us that he talks to the avatar more than he talks to her now.
And it's so like that movie. What's it called? Like, Her or something?
Exactly. So there's definitely a space for, you know, it may not be for everybody, but there's definitely certain types of people, and they gravitate to the avatar, and we see them gravitating to the avatar when they choose that mode of interaction mm-hmm. on our app. We definitely see them having just a higher level of disclosure in terms of how much they chat about with him or her.
Yeah. And I guess in a futuristic world, like, I can almost picture these avatars also becoming companions for mm-hmm. like elderly, or therapists for people who are working through mental health issues, right? Like, there's so much mm-hmm. that could happen if the psychology around feeling safe and feeling like you could mm-hmm. be open and honest with someone like mm-hmm. an avatar more so than a person is true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's advancements that are being made on all fronts.
Yeah.
The avatars are getting more realistic and more empathetic in terms of the fidelity of the kinds of emotions they can show. Speech recognition is getting better. Obviously, AI algorithms in terms of how often you follow up with somebody, what you talk to them about, what conversations you use, all those are, you know, obviously advancing. And, you know, we're participating in some of that advancement with, you know, building our own IP and our own software with engineers, but we also leverage with some, you know, some off-the-shelf tools like Google speech recognition, for instance, that also is continuously becoming higher fidelity and improved over time.
Well, I'm very excited to follow the journey, and this has been a fascinating conversation. I've learned so much about chatbots, and I'm very excited about all the different use cases in healthcare and insurance. Mm-hmm. Before we hop off, any parting words of advice for other entrepreneurs or young professionals who also want to make a difference in healthcare? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think healthcare is probably one of the hardest industries to enter in the US particularly, because it's so entrenched and because there are a lot of, you know, disincentives for business models that may seem obvious. But that's not to discourage people. That's to encourage people to help change the system and help create innovation that kind of goes beyond the existing infrastructure that is around there today. And also one of the major things I'll say is that for entrepreneurs, especially now, especially coming out of business school now or graduating now, don't look at just the U.S. market alone, particularly in healthcare. Look at the global market. The globe is much more interconnected than it ever was before, right? You can have a conversation with anybody in the world mm-hmm. in the next few seconds. Those connections and those opportunities, and there's plenty, I want to say, opportunities and connections around the world that could be much easier for your particular product or service that you offer to enter in and penetrate for the first time. As an example, our work with the NHS in the UK, you know, we're based here, but the UK is where the product really started taking off. And because of smartphone penetration, because there's, you know, consistency of, you know, the different types of software and people and services that people use around the world, borders are becoming, at least in our world, with digital assistance, borders are becoming more and more obsolete. So very closely take a look at the healthcare system design, the insurance system design in various countries to see what can actually enable you to create a product market fit faster, so you can scale faster and get that early traction that everybody needs, every new startup that needs faster. And you know, the other piece of advice is to never give up. This is a hard business. You have to be very patient, not just a patient, but patient, to kind of keep your eye on the ball and continue moving along. You know, sometimes it'll be super fast, sometimes it'll be very slow, but it's very much a roller coaster ride, and you have to watch your emotions and kind of do what the market's telling you to do.
What a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thanks very much, Dandy. Pleasure to talk to you.